This is the AAOS Career Podcast, part of the Bone Beat Orthopedic Podcast Channel. This series features conversations on professional development and growth opportunities within the field of musculoskeletal healthcare. I'm your host, Mikelyn DeFore, Chair of the AAOS Resident Assembly. Hello, everyone. Today, our special guest is Dr. Jonathan Dubin, an orthopedic traumatologist and associate program director and vice chair for research at the University of Missouri, Kansas City Medical School. He is currently also a member of the AAOS Committee on Healthcare Safety and has previously served two terms on the Committee of Devices, Biologics, and Technology, bringing a wealth of knowledge to our topic today. Dr. Dubin, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So we have a previous episode on the AAOS Career Podcast, which our listeners can check out in our library. That's episode number 16, specifically related to innovation and partnering with industry. But in this episode specifically, I want to get into the ethics and the patient safety considerations specifically in working with industry. So I think for me, one of my concerns as a soon-to-be graduating resident looking towards my future career as a brand new early career surgeon is just the sheer amount of knowledge required by all of us to know various implants and just keep up with the technology that is ever evolving, and specifically with the goal of providing the best outcomes for our patients. What is your advice specifically for early career surgeons on how to foster and how to initiate a relationship with industry and just trying to remain as impartial as possible?
You know, that's a good question. I think industry, especially for young faculty, industry and representatives are very excited to meet fresh graduates because they're, one, a little bit impressionable, they're open to change, and they're starting at a new hospital, so they have an opportunity to gain access to that hospital. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but they do approach graduates very commonly and just try to get to know them. I think the key here is realizing, I think for me, is when I went out, is I think do what's right in your, what you feel like is right in your head. And I think we've got most residents get good training and they learn how to manage the conflicts of interest, because there's conflicts of interest. A lot of decisions we make have lots of conflicts, a lot of competing decisions that have to be made. So I think it's really important to do what's right in your head and always remember the sort of the North Star of all of medicine is that we got to keep the patients first and be an impartial in our decision making. Well, are we really choosing the best implant for the patient and the best devices for them? And if we're doing that, then I think everything else falls into place. So just that North Star, that the shining light of what our most basic principle is, keep the patient first. And then that usually guides you.
Absolutely. I think you make a great point, keeping your center focus on doing what's best for the patient. It's also interesting. I've totally recognized this kind of transitioning to my chief year as a resident. The relationships we have with our reps has changed. They definitely come approach us more often, talk to us more often, seem to be a little bit more engaged on, hey, what's the plan for you next year? So with that in mind, what do you think are some of the biggest potential ethical considerations or even boundaries that either you've seen in your practice or you think are important for early career surgeons to look out for and to establish early when engaging with industry?
I think it's really early to be an open-minded. I believe it's a team. There's people who are very opposed to industry. I know that part of this stemmed from a law they're talking about, and I think it was New Hampshire. I can't exactly remember, but they're talking about preventing representatives coming into the operating room. And I think you really got to remember that. I think reps, they have they're part of a team, and you just got to understand the pros and cons that they bring to the table with the preoperative planning and the approach to the patient. But I think as a resident, I think a fresh graduate, I think keeping an open mind, contacting the people you're going to be joining, I think that's important, because a lot of times hospitals have contracts with various equipment companies already or different manufacturers. I do trauma, so we have a contract with a specific company. So it's nice when we have a new partner that they understand that we have this contract, we're open, but we should also understand that there's more at play that helps with drive down costs. And so getting feedback from your future colleagues, I think, is important. That way you can approach this as a team, but also keeping an open mind. Sometimes there is some new technology out there that is good. If you stick with the same thing over and over, you shut out the opportunities to improve. Sometimes it's just something that's really nice. And as long as you know how to balance it, you think you're doing the right thing for the patient, should be open and listen to someone that's presenting a good argument as to what their product is and give it a chance. So I think it's okay to be open, but you should use your training to understand pros and cons of the devices or whatever they're trying to sell you.
Absolutely. I think you make a good point again that Orthopedics is a team sport and industry, and our reps are a part of that. Specifically too, early career surgeons and in training, I think industry has a big impact in the ability to supplement our training, whether that's courses or cadaver labs or traveling to certain events that are industry sponsored. What are your thoughts and recommendations for the acceptance of financial support by industry for these type of sponsored training and education events?
Yeah, that's a good question. The Academy has recommendations on it, and I think that they're a great resource for that. You can certainly see exactly what the Academy overall feels, but personally, I'm mostly in line with what their recommendations are by and large. I just, again, I think, unfortunately, for better or for worse, there's not much other funding. Most universities don't have the money to pay for residents to do a lot of these courses. When I was a resident, a handful of years ago or more, one of the companies would help us do cadaver labs for arthroscopy. And that was how I got a lot of arthroscopy appearance. No one else was going to pay for that. And this was an opportunity to work at a lab. And then they let us use the cadavers after the lab was done. And so you have an opportunity there that's not really available otherwise. So I think that in that sense, it's appropriate as long as everyone understands there's no quid pro quo. And for me, there never was. It was that I think for the rep, they wanted us to just get exposed to it, but there's no quid pro quo saying, oh yeah, you came here and did this. We expect you to use our stuff when you graduate. That was never the case. I've never seen that or heard of that happening, right? But at least in my experience, I think as long as you're just getting the training that you need, getting exposure, I think that's a good thing because it's not available from other experiences. I'm an associate program director, and it's very hard to find funding for cadaver labs and any other labs. So we do appreciate the collaboration that we have with them. I think the line barrier gets crossed if in a situation were to occur, which hasn't happened with us, but it could in theory happen, when people are socially hanging out with the representative or whatever and becoming beyond acquaintances and they're becoming like friends and hanging out, and they expect the rep to pay for a dinner that had no otherwise educational value. There was no important meeting. There's no discussion of keeping it professional. That's where the line gets crossed. If you're just hanging out as buddies, you should probably pay for your own checks and pay for everything yourself. That way you keep things separate. It's just friendships. That's how you do with your friends. But if it's a professional meeting, they're trying to do a CME or they're giving you a good quality educational experience, and I think it's appropriate to have some of those ancillaries because it's hard usually in the evenings and people want to have a little dinner or whatever. I think that's more appropriate, but not if there's no educational attachment to that.
Another relationship or avenue where I've seen orthopedic surgeons, and probably this is more so our senior faculty, further their relationship with industry and even further their own ideas and innovations is as an orthopedic consultant or advisor to some sort of medical sales company. Can you describe what forms these other relationships with industry might take place?
Yeah. So front, I don't have any conflicts. I don't have any industry sponsorships or anything like that. That's not something I've been doing, but I'm on one of the FDA committees for orthopedic rehabilitation devices, but I don't have an industry sponsorships. But I think in my experience, I do a lot of research in medical devices and innovation and safety with medical device recalls. That's sort of where my area of interest has been. And I'd say from my experience, I believe it's really important to have collaboration between orthopedic surgeons, innovators, business. It takes a team. You need statisticians. You need lots of people there to really make really good modern day devices and bring new ideas to market. I think it really truly is a collaboration. After looking at it, you have to understand everyone brings something new and novel to the table. There's pros and cons. There's people have biases. Sometimes it's a financial bias. Sometimes it's just their own personal biases. And everyone has a bias and those need to be managed and everyone has to understand those, but they also bring experience and knowledge to the table, which I think that's what really is key for the partnerships. Each year, there's about 500, give or take 500 dot devices, depending on how you're going to define it, but about 500 devices that are brought to market through the 510K and some of the other pathways to market orthopedics alone. So it's hard to really, I think, stay up to date with all the devices and know every little intricacy too. And so I think it's important to have orthopedic involvement, collaboration. So that way when a device does come to market, it directly impacts the patient. It's something that has the idea that this is patient focused. And then you partner with industry. So that way there's the marketing and they can distribute it and produce it. And so I think it really is a collaboration. I think that's really the key here is understanding where everyone's side of the table, what everyone's trying to do, and then collaborate and bring what everyone's skill set is together.
That's so true too, pointing out that we all have our own bias. And the big part of that is just acknowledging it, recognizing it, and making sure that we all bring our individual experience to the table and help check each other a little bit on those biases. in addition to recognizing your biases and making sure you try to minimize that as much as possible, are there any other considerations you might recommend for surgeons, just ethical considerations or relationship with their work environment that they should consider prior to entering this collaboration?
So I think certainly you want to have your disclosures, certainly with the academy, have your disclosures so that way people know that your opinions can be biased. It's not always a negative thing. It's just that everyone's something. If you're an innovator, you truly do believe, hopefully, you truly believe that your device or whatever you've created is good for patients. So you believe in it, but there's still biases. And so you should disclose that. You should be open and upfront. That's probably the most important thing, is just be open and upfront when you disclose them on the academy. But you should also be open and upfront with patients. If you're an innovator of a device and you're using the product and you're recommending it to a patient, you should probably tell the patient, I helped design this. This is a product that I believe in, and this is why. And I think most patients are actually very open to knowing that, oh, you invented this. This is a good thing. You're very familiar with this. But I think it's if you try and hide it or it appears that you're hiding, that's really the issue comes in. So I think keeping it upfront, open, telling the people who you're working with, telling your hospital too, if, especially if it's a equipment that you're trying to get them to purchase and you have a chance to profit from it, you should be open and upfront about why you believe this is the appropriate implant for your patient and be scientific about why it's the best implant and why you're choosing it.
Definitely. And so much of this, like you're saying, is just about being transparent, being honest with your patients, your employer, your colleagues. Through your experience as a traumatologist and even through your research interests, can you share any examples that you've seen of successful collaborations between orthopedic surgeons and industry in practice?
Yeah, I think a lot of really great devices have come through collaboration. And I think here's one. I know when I was a resident, this is one. I was in San Francisco. And so the X-Stop device, so it's a spine device. And I was always intrigued. I think that's in some ways it pushed me into the research realm of FDA approval. But I remember the attending surgeons that invented that device. And I just thought it was a fascinating thing how two surgeons got together and invented a device, brought it to market, went through a lot. I remember talking to some of the Dr. Shu and Dr. Zuckerman, talking to them, just learning from their experience. I just was completely and utterly fascinated by just the whole process of inventing a device and how hard it was. And that device actually had to go through a pre-market approval pathway. So it's like a more rigorous pathway. So clinical studies and stuff. But I think it's amazing that we have clinicians out there who see an idea and think of ways to help our patients. And it's a lot of time and effort. And I thought that was one of maybe an early example just in my career where I was like, left an impression on me, on orthopedic surgeons getting involved in coming up with an innovative device.
That's a great example. Switching gears a little bit too, I think this has come across a bunch for us during like board preparation and practice, being careful about not specifically naming an individual company of a certain product that we're using, but more so trying to, you know, talk about the class or the implant. Are there strategies that you've employed yourself or you've seen employed when speaking particularly about a product, how to engage that without specifically naming products?
Yeah, sometimes it's a challenge because sometimes there's just only one product out there. If it's something's completely unique, it is what it is. And you sort of have to describe it and name it. But I think in general, I try and teach residents that the device is almost like the least important part of my entire surgery. I try and say there's the hope for obviously a lot of what I do is open reduction, internal, then fixation. And so I try and stress the open reduction and then the provisional stability. And then I was like, once we get everything there, it doesn't really matter in general what fixation device, what company we're going to use, moving them away when they create their preoperative plans, moving them away from saying, oh, we need to use the whatever nail, this company's nail. It's like we can use a cephalomedullary device or we could use whatever, a locking plate, trying to move away from naming something specifically because I want them to realize, the residents and the trainees to realize, it's actually one of the least important parts of my surgery. Like that, the different implants for a lot of what I do with internal fixation, the implants can make my life a little easier. So I might like one thing and someone else might prefer some little knickknack thing, but really it's the open reduction provisional fixation. Once you get all that, you can get your device on there and you can make pretty much most of these devices that are very similar fit if you needed to. So those are, to me, some of the smaller things. So I try and focus in on the actual surgical part and then just say whatever device, like the distal femoral locking plate or the proximal femoral, whatever it is we're doing.
I think part of that too is it's been interesting to see, especially as care becomes so patient specific and individualized, that there's been instances where I've been in clinic and a patient will come in asking for a certain company hip replacement or a certain type of spine implant. And it's always blows my mind that there's patients out there doing that much research or have had a friend that has passed along that information. What do you see specifically as the patient role or patient involvement in ensuring transparency and continuing to maintain ethical standards in our orthopedic surgeon partnership and relationship with industry?
My opinion is transparency is always good. And so getting involvement in people, I don't think we should have anything to hide. I think getting patients involved, a lot of times patients are the biggest advocates. They want access to new and novel technologies because they're the ones living with pain. So oftentimes patient advocacy groups are saying, hey, we want this new device. This even has a chance at working. Let's get it on the market and go. And this is often the FDA saying like, hey, well, you know, we got to make sure this works. It might not be safe to implement something. And so there's actually a lot of times patient advocacy groups that want novel technologies. So they're interested in it. So I think educating patients, keeping them in the loop, certainly patient advocacy groups, keeping them in the loop, what's going on, you know, treat them as like anyone wants to be treated, as smart, intelligent people have access to loads of information. It's not like a long time ago, patients, advocacy groups have access to lots of information on the internet. People are very smart. They can YouTube, Google, they can figure a lot of stuff out. Patients are very savvy nowadays. And so I think keeping them in the loop and including them with the discussions and letting them know you're an innovator. If it's that part of it, you want to let them know that you're an innovator and you're working on this, I think it's great.
In regards to that as well, we know that the AOS holds patient safety in a high regard and recognizes the importance of the relationship between patient, surgeon, industry to promote not only research and innovation, but also just to improve musculoskeletal healthcare. Can you speak specifically about how you got involved with your current position on the AOS Committee on Healthcare Safety?
Yeah, great. So I think thank you for asking. I enjoy those committees. So I think for any resident, anyone's graduate, I tell all my residents to get involved. I actually learned that from one of my mentors when I was a resident here. I remember when we were getting our graduation speech, he said, just get involved. And I kind of always run with me. It's hard to do right away. You have boards and all that. But once I went with me and I said I wanted to get involved, it adds another level, like a purpose to everything that you're doing. It's always great treating patients, but as you get more comfortable with all that, it's fun to have this extra layer of importance or more of purpose, I should say, to helping a community at large. So I wanted to get involved. I knew I was interested from about medical devices, and I just had this unique interest, and I realized that people weren't following with medical devices. They didn't seem to know, especially in the orthopedic world, they didn't seem to follow with the medical device, the FDA regulatory structure. And I just got interested in it from one of my mentors, Dr. Jenny Buckley, when I was in San Francisco. And I just stuck with me as a fellow and as a res and as an early attending. And then I realized I could join the Devices, Biologics, and Technology Committee. And that was under Dr. Jezevar and when I first started. And it's been a fantastic experience. And so I did that. I served two terms. And then think through that with some of my experience, I helped build this what's called the recall database on the Academy. And so I think I shifted a lot of my interest into healthcare safety sort of position. That was under Dr. Jason Dragoo, who's now the chair of that. And he helped me with a recall dashboard. And basically it led to contacting people at the Healthcare Safety Committee. And then I knew Dr. Julie Samora, and she was the previous chair of the committee. And I thought this was a very nice fit for me, someone who's very interested in participating in healthcare safety, especially with medical devices. And that's how I got hooked on it. And I was like, this sounds like a great place to transition to.
That's really exciting. Are there any current issues related to healthcare safety that you're particularly interested in that you guys are working on? I'd love to hear more about your recall database.
So that's something I've been doing. I think the Healthcare Safety Committee, this, I have to be honest, I just started. There's still some things. They're dealing with a lot of different aspects. We just had our meeting to talk. There's definitely ideas that they've been pursuing with outside of medical devices. But one of the ones that I think I got interested in, I'd never heard of, but this is actually a collaboration idea, I guess. We were at the FDA town hall meeting at the Academy. And so one of the speakers, he was a high up person. And I think one of the big orthopedic industry companies, he was high up there and he's talking and he mentioned there's an issue with ergonomics in some of the instruments that we use for orthopedics, like a Ronger or a pituitary. They're all essentially developed for 6-foot white males. And now with more women involved, actually, I guess there's been reports of women having cramps on the hand that just doesn't fit their hands. If you have a 5'2" female, it's not going to fit their hand as well because it's not designed for them. So there's this whole idea of like ergonomics and just the instruments that we're using. And I thought that was really interesting. I hadn't had a chance to delve into that, but that was something we talked about in the committee. I thought that was a very fascinating idea. So it was just developing instruments that work well with people of different sizes and statures. Of course, yeah, it makes sense. Like the Ronger seems to fit my hand very well. I should have probably realized the blade doesn't fit other people's hands.
That's very interesting and incredible that we have a group like that, like you guys, working to address some of these concerns. Are there any other resources that you're aware of through the AOS or elsewhere for surgeons related to monitoring healthcare safety issues?
The Academy does a very good job. I'd say they do a lot of toolkits, and I think it's underutilized, and I'm guilty of that myself. I wish I would have looked at some of these things. There's a healthcare violence, or there's a violence in healthcare toolkit. It looks fantastic. There's a whole bunch. I didn't know about it until our meeting. And so there's a whole bunch of toolkits there that I think if you have a question, the Academy is going to have something there because a lot of people have that same question, and they've provided so many resources online. So I think that'd be like the first place I'd start. There's a safety issue. That'd be the first. I'd be looking at the Academy. Their website's fantastic. That'd be the first place I'd start.
That's a great recommendation. And you're right. Sometimes it's just a matter of sitting down and looking for some of those resources and going through it. And then you realize we don't always have to recreate the wheel, that there's plenty of resources out there. We just have to find them and utilize them. Dr. Duman, thank you for sharing your expertise and knowledge related to our involvement as orthopedic surgeons with industry. It truly is a unique relationship and a team approach, and each group depends so heavily on the other. I like to wrap up every session with a quick rapid fire just to help our listeners get to know you a little bit better on a personal level. So first question is, what's your favorite surgery?
My favorite surgery. It's hard to really beat rotting the mid-shaft femur. I don't know why, even though they're not that tough, but boy, it's just, there's something very gratifying about fixing a big long bone like a femur. I can't lie. It's always fun.
I'm glad that feeling never goes away. That's exactly what I expect from a traumatologist. What is your favorite go-to OR shoes? Are you wearing cowboy boots like we are in Texas?
No, I have. I used to do dance go with Merrells are my with new inserts now. I've worn them down. So I have the new whatever inserts, the cushy inserts now. Getting a little older, I need the soft ones.
That's great. You're going for comfort. What is your favorite playlist or song in the OR to listen to?
Oh boy, I'm classic rock all the way. I can't deny that. That's got to go with my classic rock. So if an Eagle song comes on, or, and if we're calling it classic rock, I'm okay with it hurts me, but they still call Guns N' Roses classic rock now. And I'm a big Guns N' Roses fan growing up with that, but I guess that's now classic rock. It's been enough time. If that comes on, that's always a good OR day.
That's a perfect environment if you're slinging nails.
Yeah, that's right.
What are you most excited about in the future of orthopedic surgery?
So I think there's lots to be excited about. I certainly would say, since we're talking about it, it's on the tip of my mind, but certainly the innovation. I think it's so hard maybe I'm getting old now, but it's hard for me to realize, think about all the potential that exists now with all the new technologies. Like obviously AI is an easy one to chip off and just say, oh yeah, I'm excited about AI. But man, what it can do for like so many different things. Like I do a lot of, with my research, I do a lot of database management, looking at FDA databases, but artificial intelligence can do a lot of what I do really fast. And then think of what they can do if we could actually coordinate the healthcare system with the different EMRs, and you could have AI help look at that and improve healthcare outcomes. That's one thing. I think the augmented reality stuff is really neat. I think that getting computers, every time I put in a nail, I always think to myself, man, it still feels very barbaric. I'm still taking a mallet. It just feels very, there's not, with computer aid, the cars do all these fancy things, but I think we're on a cusp, and I think soon computers are just going to be part of our, and I know some people do have computers part of that, but I think it's just going to be almost standard. Computers are part of surgery, and we can do so much more through small incisions, smaller and less invasive stuff by using computer technology. So I think that's coming because it's when the cars are seeing it everywhere. So I think that's what's really exciting. I just hope my old brain can catch up to that stuff.
Absolutely. It's almost unimaginable to believe, you know, what the potential and what the future looks like in 10, 20, 30 years with the technology and everything being computer-based as it seems to be going towards. And then last question, it's the best time of the year, so I can't help but ask, who did you have in the final matchup in your March Madness bracket?
I knew it was losing. There's no chance. For the guys, I had KU because I can't see university. I'm always Jayhawk at heart. But you can't help but like Caitlin Clark. So you got to say Iowa for that. You can't help but like her. It's like impossible. She seems so good. But yeah, Jayhawks for the men's.
I love it. You're a loyal fan. That's what matters.
Yeah, that's right.
Dr. Dubin, again, thank you for sharing your expertise with us and taking the time to talk about your experience with industry and your research interests and how we can better integrate ourselves with industry while keeping our patient safety concerns and ethical considerations at highest regard. Some of these AOS patient safety resources and toolkits that we've mentioned and talked about throughout this episode will be included in the show notes when this episode airs. So for all of our listeners, be sure to take a look at those resources. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AAOS Career Podcast, part of the Bone Beat Orthopedic Podcast Channel, with production and sound design by Mission Base Media. For more information on this topic and to hear other conversations on professional development, please visit aaos.org/thebonebeat.